We've got right-wing media ecosystem, and the journalists who occupy that system have essentially abandoned traditional journalistic ethics. They're not interested in being neutral. They're not interested in being objective. They're not interested in really at getting at the facts. What they want to do is present a particular political viewpoint.
Welcome back to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack. We start today by examining an escalating issue which threatens American democracy as surely as any physical invasion. I speak of the serious information warfare being waged on democracy by China and Russia, largely on social media, which is coupled with our own homegrown attacks on democracy, which are ravaging the infrastructure from within. Both are combining to lethal effect to undermine and weaken democracy both in America and around the world. David Sloss is a national security expert who worked for the US government for 9 years as a US-Soviet arms control negotiator. He's now a distinguished law professor at Santa Clara University and author of Tyrants on Twitter. In his latest book, he provides evidence to support the very real threat he believes Russia and China are posing to the structure of democracy globally. This well-funded campaign, coupled with our own engine of manufactured falsehoods and fatuous information, which is being churned out daily by social and mainstream media, is chipping away at the foundations of our belief in journalism and in our political system. What's the overall result? Well, an increase in the rise of autocracies and a decline in democracies around the world, creating a new and unsettling shift in the world order, unparalleled since the Cold War. Well, to help us understand the global picture, we are pleased to welcome John Pfeffer, our second speaker, who's Director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's also the author of Right Across the World, The Global Networking of the Far Right and the Left Response. So let me start first with you, David. What motivated you first to write the book? And then, of course, a lot of things happened between writing it and publishing it in the world. So tell me why you had to write a new preface.
Okay, so I really got interested in the topic when revelations first came out about Russian interference in the 2016 election in the United States. So when I started on the book, I was really focused about Russian interference in the US election. But as I dug into the topic, I broadened the scope because I learned that Russia has been interfering in elections all over Europe, too. So I have a chapter on that. And China is actively engaged in information warfare. So I have a chapter also about China. And I really wanted to look at potential solutions. So the second half of the book is really focused on what do we do to address this problem. And as you mentioned, I sent the original manuscript to the publisher in November 2020, right around election day, and the publisher sent it out for outside comments. And by the time I got those outside comments back, January 6th had happened. A lot of the outside commentators were like, well, you're focused here on foreign threats. What about domestic problems? So I wrote a short preface that sort of addresses the linkage between domestic threats to democracy and foreign threats to democracy, which I think are very related, but I think require different kinds of solutions.
That's all very interesting. We've got some questions coming and I want to pose to you, but I wanted to bring back a point that you said that you felt Putin helped swing the election for Trump and assisted in the rise of nationalism in Europe.
Putin had a very, very clear idea of how he wanted to disrupt the US elections. He didn't necessarily believe that Trump could win, but he did believe that disruption of and polarization of the electorate in the United States would ultimately redound to his benefit. Similarly, he has done a similar kind of project in Europe where he has supported Euroskeptical formations, parties, movements, most of them on the far right, but some of them on the left, any group that basically thought that the European Union was, you know, a heavy-handed bureaucratic organization and they wanted to pull their country out of the European Union, or at least reduce its commitment to the European Union. That's why, you know, Putin and Viktor Orban get on so famously, Orban in Hungary, of course. It's why Putin was so, you know, supportive of the Brexit movement in the UK. But all of which is designed to basically advance Russia's position with respect to Europe and the United States. China, yes, and heavily invested in information warfare. Has China been involved in disrupting US elections? No. European elections? Not really. Australian elections? A little bit. I mean, China, for the most part, is mostly focused in terms of those operations in its own neck of the woods. And of course, it's very interested in controlling the information space within China itself. So I think there are some important distinctions between how Russia and China approach information warfare.
Let me just add, there's a great quote from somebody who used to work in the National Security Council talking about this, that Russia is a hurricane and China is climate change. Russia's approach to this whole thing is very negative and destructive, right? They wanted to undermine NATO. They wanted to undermine the European Union. They wanted, as John said, to sort of undermine democracy in the United States. Like a hurricane, Russia is a very destructive force, right? China has a much more sort of long-term vision, you know, like climate change, is willing to be sort of slow and patient and methodical in sort of gradually transforming the international order in a direction that is more to its liking, right? And just one example of how China goes and approaches this, there's a Chinese company that is effectively the, I think it's Star Times is the name, it's effectively the Comcast of Africa. They have more control over cable channels in Africa than any other country. And you know, one of the things that they do is they have this whole offering. You want to get BBC on cable, you can get that. You want to get Al Jazeera on cable, you can get that. But they package it in a way that the Chinese television networks come in for free, right? You want BBC, you got to pay extra for that, right? So a whole lot of people in Africa who don't have a whole lot of money are getting their news from Chinese sources because, hey, that's part of their cable package. They can get that and they don't have to pay extra for it. If they want BBC, though, they got to pay for that. So China is influencing the information environment all over Africa. And that's partly why you look at sort of public opinion polling from Africa. It's the African countries that are more favorable towards China than almost anywhere else in the world.
Okay, so let's try and think about how we might solve this problem. Somebody's asked, can we not cut off Russia or China from the global internet?
We cannot cut them off from the global internet. I mean, China has cut itself off from the global internet to some extent by building the so-called Great Firewall of China. And Russia has done something similar just since the invasion of Ukraine. I mean, before the invasion of Ukraine, Russian information space was a lot more open to outside penetration. But, you know, they are connected to the global internet and that's not going to be shut down. Now, what I think we can do is get Chinese and Russian state agents off of social media platforms. I think that would be a good thing to do. That would be a helpful step, would be a positive step. To make it work, you really need cooperation among liberal democracies. So in the second half of the book, I propose what I call an alliance for democracy, which would bring together about 35 or 40 states that are the leading liberal democracies in the world to come up with a sort of a common solution for regulating social media. It would have to be implemented domestically, and each country would sort of adopt its own domestic regulations. But what I'm aiming for is what international lawyers talk about as regulatory harmonization, where we get very similar regulations in all of these different countries. And I think this could be an effective technique for basically keeping Chinese and Russian state agents off of social media platforms. That's not going to prevent them from spreading propaganda in lots of other ways. It's not going to prevent them from carrying out misinformation campaigns in other ways, but it could severely limit their ability to use social media for that purpose. And I think that would be a positive and a useful step. Right. But we got to remember that the internet is a lot bigger than just social media. And I don't think we want to sort of cut them off of the internet altogether. I don't think that would be a good thing.
There was an agreement between Obama and Xi near the end of Obama's presidency, kind of an informal agreement, but one that was effective in reducing basically state hacking or hackers that were engaged in information warfare. And you saw a significant reduction in the amount of Chinese infiltrations. And many of those were corporate, of course, efforts to steal corporate secrets. In other words, I do think that there's, again, a distinction here between Russia and China in terms of policy options. I think we can sit down with the Chinese and get some agreements. Won't eliminate information warfare, but could reduce it. At the moment, unfortunately, there's not a lot of opportunities to sit down with Russia to talk about anything, but maybe at some point in the future, we can have that conversation.
You're listening to Tyrants on Twitter with its author, David Sloss, who is Professor of Law at the University of Santa Clara, and John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. I think we've got a much bigger problem internally in the United States with the non-professionalism of journalism, where people no longer know what they're reading is an opinion, or if it's someone on a rant. I feel there's got to be a lot more fact-checking, clear fact-checking alongside an article. Like, for example, I read the two speeches, last speeches that Truss and the other guy running for the Prime Minister of England. And right through the whole speeches of what they were proposing and what they did, there was fact checks. The BBC were putting alongside not true, exaggerated, 20% more. So you could see, you know, truth next to opinion or hyperbole. And I feel that's really lacking here. And I don't know why, but the press is losing ground because there's been too much lobbying to control free information, trustworthy information. And just this last week, two reporters from CNN were fired for giving speeches on television. One said Trump was a dishonest demagogue. Well, that's actually true. It might be an opinion, but it's true. Robert Reich wrote a great piece in The Guardian saying decent reporting is not violating journalistic standards. It's telling the unvarnished truth about what's happening in America today. And balanced journalism doesn't exist halfway between fact and lies. And I think we've got to start really being thorough about this stuff and calling people on lies as lies, not virtual alternative truth for somebody just telling downright lies to the American public. And I think people are feeding that as information now in their little silo on their phone, and it's not connected to the real world. That worries me more perhaps even than China and Russia. I don't know what you think.
Well, Mary, let me give a little bit of like historical context here, if I may. So for a period of about 40 years, the Federal Communications Commission, which has the authority to regulate both television and radio, applied a doctrine that they called the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine had different elements to it, but our core idea was, you know, as a journalist, as a broadcaster on either side, didn't apply to newspapers, but television, radio broadcasters, if they presented one side, they had to present the other side too. And that meant that, you know, when we turned on the radio or we turned on the television, we got at least an effort at balanced reporting, right? Under the Reagan administration in the late 80s, the Federal Communications Commission abolished the Fairness Doctrine. Interestingly, there was a Supreme Court decision from the late 1960s that said this Fairness Doctrine is constitutional. It doesn't violate the First Amendment. But the Federal Communications Commission in the 1980s says, we think it does violate the First Amendment, and so we're getting rid of it. And the Supreme Court allowed that decision to stand. And basically, it's right after the Supreme Court abolishes the Fairness Doctrine that Rush Limbaugh takes off, right? And Rush Limbaugh is really the model for, you know, right-wing political commentary masquerading as journalism. And then, you know, a little while after Rush Limbaugh, we get Fox News. And we've now got a situation. There's an excellent book by a group of scholars at Harvard called Network Propaganda. And what they show with sort of detailed empirical analysis is that we've essentially got two different media systems in the United States today. We've got what they call a right-wing media ecosystem, which about 30 to 35% of the American public is getting most of its news and information from this right-wing media ecosystem. And the journalists who occupy that system have essentially abandoned traditional journalistic ethics. They're not interested in being neutral. They're not interested in being objective. They're not interested in really getting at the facts. What they want to do is present a particular political viewpoint. And then you've got the mainstream media, where people, I think, really do care about the facts, really do care about objectivity, and they're trying to do a good job to sort of report the facts. But those two different media ecosystems don't talk to each other. The people who are inhabiting the right-wing media ecosystem, that's what they hear, that's what they see, that's what they learn, right? So it's very hard for people who are trying to get at the facts to sort of get those facts before people who are getting their news and information from this right-wing media ecosystem. Now, the other point I'll say about that is I did actually come up with a pretty detailed statutory proposal to create what I call a national endowment for fact-checking. So I agree with you that we need to do a lot more for fact-checking, and I think there are ways that we can do a much better job with fact-checking without censorship and without violating the First Amendment.
Those are very good suggestions, and I appreciate the history that you provided, David. On top of that, I would add that in the social media universe, you know, what they took out of the history of Limbaugh and the creation of this right-wing ecosphere was that polarizing content was far more popular on Facebook than, you know, just the facts. Just the facts, you might get, you know, some interest, but really polarizing content would get people to click. And that has been a real driver, I think, of some of the polarization of opinion in this country, especially as people, you know, have gravitated away from the newspapers and from television to get their news or news from social media. And so how do we address that? How do we come up with policy recommendations that would transform the social media sphere away from this kind of polarizing content? That's a very challenging question.
It is a very challenging question.
It's very worrisome when people like CNN are firing two really good journalists, one of whom was the White House correspondent. That's not a radical network. CNN, you know, is in hotels around the world. So if they're being put out to pasture for just saying, speaking truth to power, it makes you wonder, do you have to look at who owns everything in order to see what the color of the opinion being voiced is? And I think that's probably true, right? At the end of the day.
Right. Well, that's, you know, there are definitely proposals out there saying that we can sort of use antitrust law as one tool to deal with this. This is part of what Elizabeth Warren is pushing, is if you sort of, you know, break up monopolies of ownership in the, you know, the big media companies, you could get a healthier sort of media ecosystem. I don't know whether that'll work, but I think, you know, I agree with you that there's actually good documented evidence that shows in the current media environment, lies spread faster than truth. And that is a real problem. And I don't have a sort of a magic bullet solution to the problem, but I think we need to consider different creative alternatives to get at that because it's a serious issue.
Well, we need to get a lot better at it. I think the liberal, fair-minded people are not as rabid as the people that are working in the opposition to truth. And unfortunately, I think we've got to, I wouldn't say take on their tactics, but I think we've got to get a much more active role in preserving democracy and calling this stuff out for what it is. If it's propaganda or hyperbole, then we say it's hyperbole or it's opinion. It doesn't make it true or a fact. And I think that's what we've lost, that differentiation. Somebody once said that, you know, that was what was so great about old school journalism before the internet, that your job was on the line if you got it wrong. Nobody's job's on the line when they sound off on the internet. They just say what they like and then say, oh, I was just saying, you know, then it's couched in, oh, well, it suddenly wasn't really serious. It was just me saying whatever that is. And I think we've got to go back and be a lot stricter about standards. Anyway, somebody's written something here. I'm not quite sure what the question means. Isn't being terribly divided our worst weakness to outside interference? What can be done to address the great divide?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, you know, the polarization in the United States these days is as bad as it's been for a long, long time. It does weaken us both internally and externally, right? It's hard to get democracy to work properly when we're so divided internally. And it makes it easier for external adversaries to sort of exploit those divisions to intervene in our politics, right? So I do think that one piece of it is really involves fixing the broken media ecosystem and trying to create a media ecosystem in which, you know, truth prevails over lies in the marketplace of ideas. And that's not easy to do, but I think as long as, you know, we've got one group of people who are getting their so-called facts from one set of sources and a different group of people who are getting their facts from a different set of sources, it's hard to figure out how we sort of come together as a nation to work together on solving problems. I mean, there's very interesting polling data out recently that shows that one thing Democrats and Republicans actually agree on a lot to a surprising degree is that our democratic system is currently dysfunctional. They just have very different ideas about who's to blame for the problem, right? But there's actually broad agreement along partisan lines that that's a problem. So I think there's interest in solving that problem, although coming up with solutions is not easy.
I would agree with that. Although I would also say that, you know, the reasons for polarization go beyond, you know, disagreements over facts versus opinions. That here in this country, our polarization has been accentuated by anger between haves and have-nots, those who have benefited from economic reforms and those who have not benefited, as well as anger at political elites for having associated themselves with economic reforms that have benefited a minority. And unfortunately, a lot of that anger at elites spills over into anger at journalists who are perceived as being part of the elite as well. So I really think that, yes, we can reform our media, we can reform social media, but ultimately we have to look at more equitable economic policies and more participatory political mechanisms in order to really bridge this gap. A gap, by the way, here in the United States, which we can find in other countries as well. We're not unique in having a polarized population.
I mean, just a really simple thing struck me, and of course, nobody has acted upon this, but if, for example, somebody is running for office currently and they say that the vote was stolen, they're promulgating that myth, I'd say you're out. You can't run for office. Clearly, you don't support the system, the democracy that we uphold, you don't believe in. You can't run for office. That would be the end of it. To me, that is a very straightforward, direct intervention you can do right away to eliminate all these, you know, conspiracy theorists from even running for office. Right?
Well, under current First Amendment doctrine, I think that that would be unconstitutional.
If you're saying the election was stolen, what are you saying?
What are you saying?
What are you saying politically?
I mean, I think that that under current First Amendment doctrine, that is protected speech. Government can't stop you from saying that. Now, I think there's problems with the court's First Amendment doctrine, but I think first of all, you're not going to get agreement to pass that, pass a law like that. But even if you did get an agreement to pass a law like that, unfortunately, it'd be struck down.
You don't have to pass a law. When you stand up and say, I uphold the Constitution of the United States, and you swear an oath, you either do or you don't. That's simple. If you say the election was stolen, you're not in. You can't run.
But Mary, that's this last election. One can imagine a situation in which, in a future election, the election is indeed, stolen,
okay.
If you will.
Okay, I'm saying currently now to stop the rot, that would be one small intervention right now. It would get rid of that whole election was stolen. Eliminate it from the forefront and get on with the next election. I just think things like this should be nipped in the bud. And every time we get to something, everybody backs off. The courts back off. I don't know what it is. Everyone seems frightfully fearful of Trump and his cronies. And it has to be stopped, or this democracy really is going to fall apart. So, end of rant. I'm sure it's illegal, but I don't know what the answer is otherwise. If you can't speak the truth and you can't say these things, you're playing games, you're playing politics, you're not doing politics.
But we all hope for a Frank Capra like ending to this, in which people rise up and assert their democratic rights. And I'm not sure we're going to get a Frank Capra ending, but we do have examples recently in New Hampshire of a group of people in a small town who had seen their school budget slashed basically to near, in half, but near zero effectively, who then figured out a way that they could reverse that in a democratic fashion. And I think ultimately that's what we have to do. We have to figure out what democratic mechanisms we have at our disposal to nip these in the bud. I don't think we can do an end run around those, because an end run will ultimately come back and bite us in the butt at some point in the future. And strengthening our democratic institutions, strengthening our democratic participation, I think ultimately that will be the way to address tyrannical movements like Trump's movement.
Yeah, and I actually do believe that at some point the Republican Party is going to ditch Trump, and you will get a rebirth of a more sort of moderate centrist Republican Party. And one thing that may lead us in that direction is the Republicans, it's looking like they're going to do a whole lot worse in the midterms than people were talking about a few months ago. And one piece of that is that they're putting up candidates who are just too extreme for the mainstream electorate. So at some point, the message is going to get through. You put up these sort of radical extremists and you're going to lose elections. You want to win elections, you got to actually put forward some more moderate centrist candidates. So we'll see what happens. But I do think that is one, at least a piece, that's not the entire path back, but that's a piece of it. And I don't think there's one solution here. I think there's a lot of different little things. And I agree fully with John that strengthening democratic institutions, finding ways to make democracy work better. I mean, one of the problems is that a lot of the American public just does not have faith in democracy right now. A lot of skepticism about whether democratic government really works. And we have a lot of work to do to persuade people that democratic government really does work and can deliver the goods. And as John said, part of that is economically, right? That we've got this growing inequality in the country, which makes a whole lot of people very unhappy, and with good reason.
Thank you, David Sloss and John Pfeffer, for all your input and insights today. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, and of course you. So if you want to donate, go to our website, cambridgeforum.org. And thank you all so very much for joining us. See you again soon.